The Augsburg Confession, Chapter 8, Effect on the Romanists. The Romanists had expected nothing like this. Instead of a hateful controversy, they had heard a striking confession of Jesus Christ. The most hostile minds were consequently disarmed. "We would not for a great deal," was the remark on every side, "have missed being present at this reading." The effect was so prompt that for an instant the cause was thought to be definitively gained. The bishops themselves imposed silence on the sophisms and clamors of the Fabers and the Ecks. "All that the Lutherans have said is true," exclaimed the Bishop of Augsburg. "We cannot deny it." "Well, doctor," said the Duke of Bavaria to Eck in a reproachful tone, "you had given me a very different idea of this doctrine and of this affair." This was the general cry. Accordingly, the sophists, as they called them, were embarrassed. "But after all," said the Duke of Bavaria to them, "can you refute by sound reasons the confession made by the elector and his allies?" "With the writings of the apostles and prophets, no," replied Eck. "But with those of the fathers and of the councils, yes." "I understand," quickly replied the Duke. "I understand. The Lutherans, according to you, are in Scripture, and we are outside." The Archbishop Hermann, Elector of Cologne, the Count Palatine Frederick, Duke Eric of Brunswick-Lüneburg, Duke Henry of Mecklenburg, and the Dukes of Pomerania, were gained over to the truth, and Hermann sought ere long to establish it in his electorate. The impression produced in other countries by the confession was perhaps still greater. Charles sent copies to all the courts. It was translated into French, Italian, and even into Spanish and Portuguese. It circulated through all Europe, and thus accomplished what Luther had said: "Our confession will penetrate into every court, and the sound thereof will spread through the whole earth." It destroyed the prejudices that had been entertained, gave Europe a sounder idea of the Reformation, and prepared the most distant countries to receive the seeds of the gospel. Then Luther's voice began to be heard again. He saw that it was a decisive moment, and that he ought now to give the impulse that would gain religious liberty. He boldly demanded this liberty of the Roman Catholic princes of the Diet, and at the same time endeavored to make his friends quit Augsburg. Jesus Christ had been boldly confessed. Instead of that long series of quarrels and discussions which was about to become connected with this courageous act, Luther would have wished for a striking rupture, even should he seal with his blood the testimony rendered to the gospel. The stake, in his idea, would have been the real catastrophe of this tragedy. "I absolve you from this diet, in the name of the Lord," wrote he to his friends. "Now home, return home, again I say home. Would to God that I were the sacrifice offered to this new council, as John Huss at Constance." But Luther did not expect so glorious a conclusion. He compared the diet to a drama. First, there had been the exposition, then the prologue, afterwards the action, and now he waited for the tragic catastrophe, according to some, but which, in his opinion, would be merely comic. Everything, he thought, would be sacrificed to political peace, and dogmas would be set aside. This proceeding, which, even in our own days, would be in the eyes of the world the height of wisdom, was in Luther's eyes the height of folly. He was especially alarmed at the thought of Charles's intervention, to withdraw the church from all secular influence, and the governments from all clerical influence, was then one of the dominant ideas of the great reformer. "You see," wrote he to Melanchthon, "that they oppose to our cause the same argument as at Worms, to wit, still and forever the judgment of the emperor. Thus Satan is always harping on the same string, 1361, and that emaciated strength of the civil power is the only one which this myriad wild spirit is able to find against Jesus Christ." But Luther took courage, and boldly raised his head. "Christ is coming," continued he. "He is coming, sitting at the right hand, of whom? Not of the emperor, or we should long ago have been lost, but of God himself. Let us fear nothing. Christ is the King of kings and the Lord of lords. If he loses this title at Augsburg, he must also lose it in all the earth and in all the heavens." Thus a song of triumph was, on the part of the confessors of Augsburg, the first movement that followed this courageous act, unique doubtless in the annals of the church. Some of their adversaries at first shared in their triumph, and the others were silent, but a powerful reaction took place ere long. On the following morning, Charles, having risen in ill humor and tired for want of sleep, the first of his ministers who appeared in the imperial apartments was the Count Palatine, as wearied and embarrassed as his master. "We must yield something," said he to Charles. And I would remind your majesty that the Emperor Maximilian was willing to grant the two kinds in the Eucharist, the marriage of priests, and liberty with respect to the fasts. Charles V eagerly seized at this proposition as a means of safety. But Granvelle and Campeggio soon arrived, who induced him to withdraw it. Rome, bewildered for a moment by the blow that had struck her, rose up again with energy. "I stay with the mother," exclaimed the Bishop of Wartburg, meaning by it the Church of Rome.
"The mother, the mother!"
"My lord," wittily replied Brentz.
"Pray do not, for the mother, forget either the father or the son."
"Well, I grant it," replied the Archbishop of Salzburg to one of his friends. "I also should desire the communion in both kinds, the marriage of priests, the reformation of the Mass, and liberty as regards food and other traditions, but that it should be a monk, a poor monk, who presumes to reform us all, is what we cannot tolerate."
"I should have no objection," said another bishop, "for divine worship to be celebrated everywhere as it is at Wittenberg, but we can never consent that this new doctrine should issue from such a corner."
And Melanchthon insisting with the Archbishop of Salzburg on the necessity of a reform of the clergy.
"Well, and how can you wish to 1362 reform us?" said the latter abruptly.
"We priests have always been good for nothing. This is one of the most ingenuous confessions that the Reformation has torn from the priests. Every day fanatical monks and doctors, brimful of sophisms, were seen arriving at Augsburg, who endeavored to inflame the hatred of the emperor and of the princes."
"If we formerly had friends," said Melanchthon on the morrow of the confession,
"now we possess them no longer. We are here alone, abandoned by all, and contending against measureless dangers."
Charles, impelled by these contrary parties, affected a great indifference. But without permitting it to be seen, he endeavored, meanwhile, to examine this affair thoroughly.
"Let there not be a word wanting," he had said to his secretary, when requiring from him a French translation of the confession.
"He does not allow anything to be observed," whispered the Protestants one to another, convinced that Charles was gained.
"For if it were known, he would lose his Spanish states. Let us maintain the most profound secrecy." But the emperor's courtiers, who perceived these strange hopes, smiled and shook their heads.
"If you have money," said Schepper, one of the secretaries of state, to Jonas and Melanchthon,
"it will be easy for you to buy from the Italians whatever religion you please. But if your purse is empty, your cause is lost." Then assuming a more serious tone,
"It is impossible," said he,
"for the emperor, surrounded as he is by bishops and cardinals, to approve of any other religion than that of the Pope."
This was soon evident.
On the day after the confession, Sunday, June 26, before the breakfast hour, all the deputations from the imperial cities were collected in the emperor's antechamber. Charles, desirous of bringing back the states of the empire to unity, began with the weakest.
"Some of the cities," said the Count Palatine,
"have not adhered to the last Diet of Spires. The emperor calls upon them to submit to it. Strasbourg, Nuremberg, Constance, Ulm, Reutlingen, Heilbronn, Memmingen, Lindau, Kempten, Windsheim, Isny, and Weissenberg, which were thus summoned to renounce the famous protest, thought the moment curiously chosen. They asked for time. The position was complicated. Discord had been thrown in the midst of the cities, and intrigue was laboring daily to increase it. It was not only between the popish and the evangelical cities that disagreement existed, but also between the Zwinglian and the Lutheran cities, and even among the latter, those which had not adhered to the confession of Augsburg manifested great ill-humor towards the deputies of Reutlingen and Nuremberg. This proceeding of Charles V was therefore skillfully calculated, for it was based on the old axiom, divide et impera. But the enthusiasm of faith overcame all these stratagems, and on the next day, June 27, the deputies from the cities transmitted a reply to the emperor, in which they declared that they could not adhere to the recess of spires, without disobeying God, and without compromising the salvation of their souls. Charles, who desired to observe a just medium, more from policy than from equity, wavered between so many contrary convictions. Desirous nevertheless of essaying his mediating influence, he convoked the states faithful to Rome, on Sunday, June 26, shortly after his conference with the cities. All the princes were present, even the Pope's legate and the most influential Roman divines appeared at this council, to the great scandal of the Protestants.
"What reply should be made to the confession?"
was the question set by Charles V to the Senate that surrounded him.
Three different opinions were proposed. "Let us beware," said the men of the papacy, "of discussing our adversary's reasons, and let us be content with executing the Edict of Worms against the Lutherans, and with constraining them by arms. Let us submit the confession to the examination of impartial judges," said the men of the empire, "and refer the final decision to the emperor. Is not even the reading of the confession an appeal of the Protestants to the imperial power?" Others, in the last place, and these were the men of tradition and of ecclesiastical doctrine, were desirous of commissioning certain doctors to compose a refutation, which should be read to the Protestants and ratified by Charles. The debate was very animated. The mild and the violent, the politic and the fanatical, took a decided course in the assembly. George of Saxony and Joachim of Brandenburg showed themselves the most inveterate, and surpassed in this respect even the ecclesiastical princes. "A certain clown, whom you know well, is pushing them all from behind," wrote Melanchthon to Luther, "and certain hypocritical theologians hold the torch and lead the whole band." This clown was doubtless Duke George. Even the princes of Bavaria, whom the confession had staggered at first, immediately rallied around the chiefs of the Roman party. The Elector of Mentz, the Bishop of Augsburg, the Duke of Brunswick, showed themselves the least unfavorable to the evangelical cause. "I can by no means advise His Majesty to employ force," said Albert. "If His Majesty should constrain their consciences, and should afterwards quit the empire, the first victims sacrificed would be the priests. And who knows whether, in the midst of these discords, the Turks would not suddenly fall upon us." But this somewhat interested wisdom of the archbishop did not find many supporters, and the men of war immediately plunged into the discussion with their harsh voices. "If there is any fighting against the Lutherans," said Count Felix of Wurttemberg, "I gratuitously offer my sword, and I swear never to return it to its scabbard until it has overthrown the stronghold of Luther." This nobleman died suddenly a few days after, from the consequences of his intemperance. Then the moderate men again interfered. "The Lutherans attack no one article of the faith," said the Bishop of Augsburg. "Let us come to an arrangement with them, and to obtain peace, let us concede to them the sacrament in both kinds and the marriage of priests. I would even yield more, if it were necessary." Upon this loud cries arose, "He is a Lutheran," they exclaimed, "and you will see that he is fully prepared to sacrifice even the private masses." "The masses, we must not even think of it," remarked some with an ironical smile. "Rome will never give them up, for it is they which maintain her cardinals and her courtiers, with their luxury and their kitchens." The Archbishop of Salzburg and the Elector of Brandenburg replied with great violence to the motion of the Bishop of Augsburg. "The Lutherans," said they abruptly, "have laid before us a confession written with black ink on white paper. Well, if I were emperor, I would answer them with red ink." "Sirs," quickly replied the Bishop of Augsburg, "take care then that the red letters do not fly in your faces." The Elector of Mentz was compelled to interfere and calm the speakers. The emperor, desirous of playing the character of an umpire, would have wished the Roman party at least to have placed in his hands an act of accusation against the reform. But all was now altered. The majority, becoming daily more compact since the Diet of Spires, no longer sided with Charles. Full of the sentiment of their own strength, they refused to assume the title of a party, and to take the emperor as a judge. "What are you saying?" cried they. "Of diversity between the members of the empire? There is but one legitimate party. It is not a question of deciding between two opinions whose rights are equal, but of crushing rebels, and of aiding those who have remained faithful to the constitution of the empire." This haughty language enlightened Charles. He found they had outstripped him, and that, abandoning his lofty position of arbiter, he must submit merely to be the executor of the orders of the majority. It was this majority which henceforward commanded in Augsburg. They excluded the imperial counselors who advocated more equitable views, and the Archbishop of Mentz himself ceased for a time to appear in the Diet. The majority ordered that a refutation of the evangelical doctrine should be immediately drawn up by Romish theologians. If they had selected for this purpose moderate men like the Bishop of Augsburg, the Reformation would still have had some chance of success with the great principles of Christianity. But it was to the enemies of the Reform, to the old champions of Rome and of Aristotle, exasperated by so many defeats, that they resolved to entrust this task. They were numerous at Augsburg, and not held in very great esteem. "The princes," said Jonas, have brought their learned men with them, and some even their unlearned and their fools. Provost Faber and Dr. Eck led the troop. Behind them was drawn up a cohort of monks, and above all of Dominicans, tools of the Inquisition, and impatient to recompense themselves for the opprobrium they had so long endured. There was the provincial of the Dominicans, Paul Hugo, their vicar John Burkard, one of their priors Conrad Colian, who had written against Luther's marriage, with a number of Carthusians, Augustines, Franciscans, and the vicars of several bishops. Such were the men who, to the number of 20, were commissioned to refute Melanchthon. One might beforehand have augured of the work by the workmen. Each one understood that it was a question, not of refuting the confession, but of branding it. Campeggio, who doubtless suggested this ill-omened list to Charles, was well aware that these doctors were incapable of measuring themselves with Melanchthon, but their names formed the most decided standard of popery, and announced to the world clearly and immediately what the Diet proposed to do. This was the essential point. Rome would not leave Christendom even hope. It was, however, requisite to know whether the Diet, and the Emperor who was its organ, had the right of pronouncing in this purely religious matter. Charles put the question both to the evangelicals and to the Romanists. "Your Highness," said Luther, who was consulted by the elector, "may reply with all assurance, yes, if the emperor wish it, let him be judge. I will bear everything on his part, but let him decide nothing contrary to the word of God. Your Highness cannot put the emperor above God himself. Does not the first commandment say, 'Thou shalt have no other gods before me?'" The reply of the papal adherents was quite as positive in a contrary sense. "We think," said they, "that His Majesty, in accord with the electors, princes, and states of the empire, has the right to proceed in this affair, as Roman emperor, guardian, advocate, and sovereign protector of the church and of our most holy faith." Thus, in the first days of the Reformation, the evangelical church frankly ranged itself under the throne of Jesus Christ, and the Roman Church under the scepter of kings. Enlightened men, even among Protestants, have misunderstood this double nature of Protestantism and popery. The philosophy of Aristotle and the hierarchy of Rome, thanks to this alliance with the civil power, were at length about to see the day of their long-expected triumph arrive. So long as the schoolmen had been left to the force of their syllogisms and of their abuse, they had been defeated. But now Charles V and the Diet held out their hands to them. The reasonings of Faber, Eck, and Wimpina were about to be countersigned by the German Chancellor, and confirmed by the great seals of the Empire. Who could resist them? The Romish error has never had any strength except by its union with the secular arm, and its victories in the old, and in the new world are owing, even in our days, to state patronage. These things did not escape the piercing eye of Luther. He saw at once the weakness of the argument of the papist doctors and the power of Charles's arm. "You are waiting for your adversary's answer," wrote he to his friends in Augsburg. "It is already written, and here it is, the fathers, the fathers, the fathers, the church, the church, the church, usage, custom, but of the scriptures nothing. Then the emperor, supported by the testimony of these arbiters, will pronounce against you, and then will you hear boastings from all sides that will ascend up to heaven, and threats that will descend even to hell." Thus changed the situation of the reform. Charles was obliged to acknowledge his weakness, and to save the appearance of his power, he took a decisive part with the enemies of Luther. The emperor's impartiality disappeared, the state turned against the gospel, and there remained for it no other savior than God. At first many gave way to extreme dejection, above all, Melanchthon, who had a nearer view of the cabals of the adversaries, exhausted moreover by long vigils, fell almost into despair. "In the presence of these formidable evils," cried he, "I see no more hope." And then, however, he added, "except the help of God." The legate immediately set all his batteries to work. Already had Charles several times sent for the elector and the landgrave, and had used every exertion to detach them from the evangelical confession. Melanchthon, uneasy at these secret conferences, reduced the confession to its minimum, and entreated the elector to demand only the two kinds in the Eucharist and the marriage of priests. "To interdict the former of these points," said he, "would be to alienate a great number of Christians from the communion, and to forbid the second would be depriving the church of all the pastors capable of edifying it. Will they destroy religion and kindle civil war, rather than apply to these purely ecclesiastical constitutions a mitigation that is either contrary to sound morals nor to faith? The Protestant princes begged Melanchthon to go himself and make these proposals to the legate. Melanchthon agreed. He began to flatter himself with success, and in truth, there were, even among the papists, individuals who were favorable to the Reformation. There had recently arrived at Augsburg, from beyond the Alps, certain propositions tolerably Lutheran, and one of the emperor's confessors boldly professed the doctrine of justification by faith, cursing those asses of Germans, said he, who are incessantly braying against this truth. One of Charles's chaplains approved even the whole of the confession. There was something farther still, Charles V having consulted the grandees of Spain, who were famous for their orthodoxy. If the opinions of the Protestants are contrary to the articles of the faith, they had replied, let your majesty employ all his power to destroy this faction. But if it is a question merely of certain changes in human ordinances and external usages, let all violence be avoided. Admirable reply! Exclaimed Melanchthon, who persuaded himself that the Romish doctrine was at the bottom in accordance with the gospel. The Reformation found defenders in even still higher stations. Mary, sister of Charles V, and widow of King Louis of Hungary, arriving at Augsburg 3 days after the reading of the confession, with her sister-in-law the Queen of Bohemia, Ferdinand's wife, assiduously studied the Holy Scriptures. She carried them with her to the hunting parties, in which she found little pleasure, and had discovered therein the jewel of the reform, the doctrine of gratuitous salvation. This pious princess made her chaplain read evangelical sermons to her, and often endeavored, although with prudence, to appease her brother Charles with regard to the Protestants. Melanchthon, encouraged by these demonstrations, and at the same time alarmed by the threats of war that the adversaries did not cease from uttering, thought it his duty to purchase peace at any cost, and resolved in consequence to descend in his propositions as low as possible. He therefore demanded an interview with the legate in a letter whose authenticity has been unreasonably doubted. At the decisive moment the heart of the reformed champion fails, his head turns, he staggers, he falls, and in his fall he runs the risk of dragging with him the cause which martyrs have already watered with their blood. Thus speaks the representative of the Reformation to the representative of the papacy. There is no doctrine in which we differ from the Roman Church. We venerate the universal authority of the Roman Pontiff, and we are ready to obey him, provided he does not reject us, and that of his clemency, which he is accustomed to show towards all nations, he will kindly pardon or approve certain little things that it is no longer possible for us to change. Now then, will you reject those who appear as suppliants before you? Will you pursue them with fire and sword? Alas! Nothing draws upon us in Germany so much hatred as the unshaken firmness with which we maintain the doctrines of the Roman Church. But with the aid of God, we will remain faithful, even unto death, to Christ and to the Roman Church, although you should reject us. Thus did Melanchthon humble himself. God permitted this fall, that future ages might clearly see how low the Reformation was willing to descend in order to maintain unity, and that no one might doubt that the schism had come from Rome. But also, assuredly, that they might learn how great, in every important work, is the weakness of the noblest instruments. Fortunately, there was then another man who upheld the honor of the Reformation. At this very time Luther wrote to Melanchthon, there can be no concord between Christ and Belial. As far as regards me, I will not yield a hair's breadth. Sooner than yield, I should prefer suffering everything, even the most terrible evils. Concede so much the less, as your adversaries require the more. God will not aid us until we are abandoned by all. And fearing some weakness on the part of his friends, Luther added, if it were not tempting God, you would long ago have seen me at your side. Never, in fact, had Luther's presence been so necessary, for the legate had consented to an interview, and Melanchthon was about to pay court to Campeggio. The 8th of July was the day appointed by the legate. His letter inspired Philip with the most sanguine hopes. The cardinal assures me that he will accede the usage of the two kinds, and the marriage of priests, said he. I am eager to visit him. This visit might decide the destiny of the church. If the legate accepted Philip's ultimatum, the evangelical countries would be replaced under the power of the Romish bishops, and all would have been over with the Reformation. But it was saved through the pride and blindness of Rome. The papists, believing it on the brink of the abyss, thought that a last blow would settle it, and resolved, like Luther, to concede nothing. Not even a hair's breadth. The legate, however, even while refusing, assumed an air of kindness and of yielding to foreign influence. I might have the power of making certain concessions, but it would not be prudent to use it without the consent of the German princes. Their will must be done. One of them in particular conjures the emperor to prevent us from yielding the least thing. I can grant nothing. The Roman prince, with the most amiable smile, then did all he could to gain the chief of the Protestant teacher. Melanchthon retired filled with shame at the advances he had made, but still deceived by Campeggio. No doubt, said he. Eck and Cochleus have been beforehand with me at the legates. Luther entertained a different opinion. I do not trust to any of these Italians, said he. They are scoundrels. When an Italian is good, he is very good, but then he is a black swan. It was truly the Italians who were concerned. Shortly after the 12th of July arrived the Pope's instructions. He had received the confession by express, and 16 days had sufficed for the transmission, the deliberation, and the return. Clement would hear no mention either of discussions or of council. Charles was to march straight to the mark, to send an army into Germany, and stifle the Reformation by force. At Augsburg, however, it was thought best not to go so quickly to work, and recourse was had to other means. Be quiet, we have them, said the Romish doctors. Sensible of the reproach that had been made against them, of having misrepresented the Reformation, they accused the Protestants themselves of being the cause. These it is, they said, who, to give themselves an air of being in accord with us, now dissemble their heresy, but we will catch them in their own nets. If they confess to not having inserted in their confession all that they reject, it will be proved that they are trifling with us. If, on the contrary, they pretend to have said everything, they will by that very circumstance be compelled to admit all that they have not condemned. The Protestant princes were therefore called together, and they were asked if the Reformation was confined to the doctrines indicated in the Apology, or if there was something more. The snare was skillfully laid. The papacy had not even been mentioned in Melanchthon's confession. Other errors besides had been omitted, and Luther himself complained of it aloud. Satan sees clearly, said he, that your apology has passed lightly over the articles of purgatory, the worship of saints, and above all, of the Pope and of Antichrist. The princes requested to confer with their allies of the towns, and all the Protestants assembled to deliberate on this momentous incident. They looked for Melanchthon's explanation, who did not decline the responsibility of the affair. Easily dejected through his own anxiety, he became bold whenever he was directly attacked. All the essential doctrines, said he, have been set forth in the confession, and every error and abuse that is opposed to them has been pointed out. But was it necessary to plunge into all those questions so full of contention and animosity that are discussed in our universities? Was it necessary to ask if all Christians are priests, if the primacy of the Pope is of right divine, if there can be indulgences, if every good work is a deadly sin, if there are more than 7 sacraments, if they may be administered by a layman, if divine election has any foundation in our own merits, if sacerdotal consecration impresses an indelible character, if auricular confession is necessary to salvation? No, no! All these things are in the province of the schools, and by no means essential to faith. It cannot be denied that in the questions thus pointed out by Melanchthon there were important points. However that may be, the evangelical committee were soon agreed, and on the morrow they gave an answer to Charles's ministers, drawn up with as much frankness as firmness, in which they said that the Protestants, desirous of arriving at a cordial understanding, had not wished to complicate their situation, and had proposed not to specify all the errors that had been introduced into the Church, but to confess all the doctrines that were essential to salvation, that if, nevertheless, the adverse party felt itself urged to maintain certain abuses, or to put forward any point not mentioned in the confession, the Protestants declared themselves ready to reply in conformity with the Word of God. The tone of this answer showed pretty clearly that the evangelical Christians did not fear to follow their adversaries wherever the latter should call them. Accordingly, the Roman party said no more on this business.